Today is September 20th, 12:26. We're recording DPBC with our guest, Alan Chappelle, the president of Chappelle and Associates, a friend of ours for several years, counsel to Pedro, and
yes,
incredible rock musician.
Yes, very, very happy to have him on the episode. We've tried before and have had technical difficulties. Tried to get him on here from his houseboat. We crashed that episode and it didn't work. Yeah. So I'm just happy we're finally getting this to work.
Yeah, he's a incredibly incisive, smart human in our space.
He knows the things, man. He knows the things, yeah. But he's a full rounded person. He's not like just like a privacy wonky person. Like he's an interesting guy to work with, and like I love partnering with him on real work, like not just podcast recordings, because he's got a big brain, man, and he's got a lot of good ideas, and he's got a lot of experience having worked in the ad tech space, all going all the way back to, you know, like early like Blue Kai days and before.
Yeah.
So like he knows things, man. He just knows things.
He can go hyper practical and hyper theoretical.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, I like a good philosophical conversation. So
they gotta have room for both.
Yeah. And I think listeners are gonna really like our chat with him. It was really good.
All right. Here it is. All right, here we are. We did it.
Hey, we're here.
We did it. Okay. We got Alan Chappelle with us.
Been trying for 2 years.
Well, I had to organize it with my tour schedule. You know how it is.
Yes. Well, so last time we talked to you, we had audio issues, and it wasn't because of the fact that you were on a houseboat, but are you in fact still on your houseboat, or are you somewhere else?
No, we're back in New York City in the West Village.
Okay.
It's school time, so the baby's gotta head out to school.
Excellent. Okay. All right. Well, you mentioned music. I think it's always a good place to start with you. I guess this is a good question. Are you a privacy lawyer first, or a musician first, or neither?
I'm nothing. Look, I'm really fortunate, so I don't want to create the impression that I don't love what I do, because I really do. I've been doing it for a long time, but I still see myself as a musician who pays the bills by doing privacy stuff.
I remember the first time, I don't even think it was the first time we met, it was the first time I saw you. I went to an NAI summit and you were speaking on a panel. It was my first one. I was brand new. I think it was like 2014, maybe 2013. And you had long hair at the time. And you were wearing a suit and you had long hair. And I was like, I hadn't seen a lot of lawyers doing that, like having their own expression of themselves as they're talking about, you know, really, really sort of cutting edge and interesting privacy issues. And I was sort of like, oh my gosh, who is this guy? And I love that. I love that. How do you keep bringing yourself to your work all the time? Because you definitely do that.
Yeah. It's a great question, because as I was growing up, I mean, my parents were still of the generation that you kept your work life very separate from your personal life, almost to the, you know, my dad was almost afraid to tell people that he was a jazz musician and that he played cards for money on the weekends. And maybe the second one of his good he didn't share, but as a jazz musician, you know, he was sort of afraid to bring that up in work circles. And for me, I've embraced it. Like I've played concerts with, with clients. I've done the Ad Week Battle of the Bands. I mean, that stuff, that's just who I am. And so if you're going to work with me, you're going to get me. And because I don't know how else to do it.
Life's too short.
Life is way too short.
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
Life is way too short. You know, I love the way you framed the your work life vis-a-vis your whole life, which work only is one piece of, which is like, I do the privacy stuff to pay the bills so I can do this other stuff. And like, I posted about this on LinkedIn recently. I don't remember exactly what it was. I think it was on some music post. I'm not a musician, but I said, you know, like my love for music far exceeds my talents in any way. And I ended up in this like privacy niche to like make a living. But like my passion and heart, I mean, look, you can build a passion around something you're really good at or you work really hard at. And I think we all are good at this work and we care about it. But man, I got to tell you, when I'm on the motorcycle, like the last thing I'm thinking about is this, right? And like, I mean, you guys know this. Like, I ride my motorcycle around the country all the time and do all these things. And like, that's really where my head and heart is most of the time. It's like, how do I get into that? I'm never going to make any money doing that. I'm not a motorcycle racer, and I just hope not to fall off my bike and crash most of the time. But it is what I love to do. And the privacy shit pays for all of it, okay? It pays for the motorcycles. It pays for the trips. It pays for the adventuring. It pays for the, you know, equipment. It pays for all the things. And so, like, in a way, and maybe you disagree, but like, in a way, the passions are commingled, because I know I have to be really good at this thing and do a really good job at this thing to have the freedom to do the other thing however I want.
Oh, absolutely. And I find myself bringing the music thing into the privacy thing. I mean, I go and I speak to people, and you know, part of privacy is communicating with people, is finding ways to reach out to people to get them to do this amorphous thing that you know they should do, but sometimes they aren't really legally compelled to do it, but you know, and so you've got to find a path. And so the music thing, if you can get up in front of, you know, 500 or 600 people and communicate or tell a story, or because if they like you, they're going to listen to you and they're going to root for you. And that works in music. It also works in privacy.
Do you think we need to cultivate this kind of skill set more as folks doing and working in an area of the law that is so dynamic and nascent and requires you to like communicate a lot in order to develop a position? And we don't live in an antitrust, you know, practice area where there's just like, the law has been the law for a long time, and you know, we're in a different place. Do we think about it differently because of that?
I think so. I certainly do. I think that you really have to come in here and think a little different, because if you're not entertaining, the business folks aren't going to listen to you, and if they're not listening to you, then nothing's going to get done. And I think that's a point that privacy people sort of aspire to. But I don't feel like in general the privacy profession is dynamic enough.
It is not.
What about you, Andy? What's your music or motor? Is it tennis? Like, what is it? Cooking?
It's tennis. I mean, I think it's hard not to like think about your life as a parent in another way as well, and think about how much you do the other things in your life, you know, to be able to support your ability to be a parent. But if you set aside parenting for a minute, like, because it could be about personal passion. And so I think it's tennis. I think it's cooking. I think it's like, you know, shared interests with my wife and my friends. Just spending time with my friends, frankly. I do the other things so that I can go. I'm a person that gets a big, you know, whether you're introvert or extrovert or whatever those definitions may be, I get energy by being with friends, and other people maybe get energy by being alone.
Yeah, me, I like a mix. I like a mix. I really do cherish my alone time. That's how I write. There are some people that can be in a big crowded room and be productive. My wife is like that. I mean, she'll sit in the middle of a party with her parents down in Managua and we'll be able to work on a presentation and we'll thrive in that environment. And we're like, I need almost complete silence.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you both. She sounds
like a nutcase in the best ways, of course.
I wanted to ask you both about writing. Alan, you mentioned writing, and you might be talking about music or another writing, but like, I wanted to ask you both this because, Alan, you've written a lot of what I've read are pieces in Ad Exchanger that are really, really well written and cogent and get to the heart of issues. And Pedro, I've had you like read a lot of my writing before. You're like a really clean writer. How have you guys perfected that over the years? And what do you think it, you know, how does it make you better?
I think that's a great question. So I it's funny. When I was in college, all my friends made fun of me because they're all business majors, and I could say, okay, you keep taking those multiple choice tests. And all my classes were such that like it was, you know, 220 page papers, and a written final. And it turns out, like, I don't want to pretend that I had this great strategy. I just did what I thought I was pretty good at. But it turns out that's all I do all day is, you know, put together little missives to share a point of view. And heck, I now, like, a large chunk of my business is this monthly report that is basically a 20-page overview of the top issues impacting the data-driven advertising issue when it comes to privacy. And I could not do that, I think, had I not had the experiences over the last, 20 or 30 years just writing.
I didn't know you did that. Real quick, Pedro, I think people would want to know, how do they get that? How do they get their hands on that?
Well, you can find me on LinkedIn. I do have a free version, which I call the Chappelle Brief, and it's not the level of depth, but it does kind of give you the overview and some insight. And then, you know, this is it's a report sort of like if Forrester tried to do something like this in terms of the pricing, or Gartner. It's a real, like, behind the scenes look.
Nice. All right. Sorry, Pedro. I didn't mean to.
No problem. First of all, I've been not just paying for that report, but Allen Services for a long time, and they're really valuable to me. And I, as long as you'll have me as a client, I will keep paying, because I do think like it's more than a report, because I think, like, report makes it sounds like it's like just hitting us with the facts, but it does also include, Allen, like, your insights, which are almost always pretty spot on. It's rarely like I believe or I think. It's more like the evidence suggests, or like history tells me, or, you know, my experience makes me conclude. And, like, that to me is super valuable, because, like, I think, I believe, I can write that myself. I got thoughts and beliefs about all sorts of shit. It's more like you're like, well, because of these five things that happened over the last 10 years, and here's what they are, this is probably where this is heading. And, like, that's actionable for me, because, like, I can turn that into, like, concrete signal to my internal clients. So, let me just vouch for the report, because I think it's good. I've been using it since my days, I think, at Oracle, definitely Salesforce, and here. And my team finds it invaluable, to the point where we send it to, like, business people. Like, it's like we send it to all sorts of people. So it's really helpful. As far as, like, your question about writing specifically, Andy, like, one of the things I think that makes Alan's writing really persuasive and sort of, like, authoritative is the plain tone of the writing. Right? Like, there is no, like, superlatives or hyperbole in the text. And, like, while I am a very animated, like, in-person speaker, you asked me about the clarity of my writing. If you read things I write, I'm rarely animated. I'm very sort of, like, matter of fact in tone. And what I think that does is it calms readers so that they can receive the message. So, like, one piece is, like, tone down all the bullshit in your writing, right? Like, this is really, really exciting. It's just, like, wasty talk. It's just, like, just saying, it's not cool. And then I think the other piece that I find valuable in communicating my exact sentiment is, like, and this is from Strunk and White model of writing, right? Which is, like, every word must tell. I am of the Hemingway Strunk and White model of writing. I don't think verboseness facilitates understanding almost ever. And so, not tearing things down and removing details, but being crisp about the words you're using to mean exactly what you're trying to say and saying nothing else is really important, I think, in communicating. And I, like, try to do both those things when I write, which is tone down, like, the, like, fancy words and, like, hyperbole and superlatives, and then only say the things I want to say.
Do you guys feel like that helps you in contract drafting when you've had to do that? I feel like it helps me. Like, cause I was trained by a verbose, terrible contract writer. And I just sort of vowed, like, it just doesn't have to be this way. Let me try to write these contracts.
I think so. Like, one of the first tasks I ever got at Oracle, and I'm brand new, you know, Oracle was getting into the data monetization business and, like, the ad tech business, and like, they needed a contract, a data licensing contract. And so they said, hey, you want to write this contract? I said, sure. And then they handed me the Oracle manual for, like, contract briefing. And it was, like, you know, 500 pages. And I literally went to my boss, who at the time was Bert Kaminsky, by the way. Shout out to Bert, who's been on the
show. All right.
I went to Bert and I said, hey, this isn't going to work, man. Like the ad tech business isn't down with the 500-page MSAs. We got to come up with something new. Like, will you give me the space to do it? And him And Alan Clark, who was Burt's manager, the head of commercial legal at the time, said, yeah, fucking go for it. And we wrote a 2-page data licensing contract instead of a 500-page data licensing contract. And I, to this day, get feedback from people in that business, all the way to Eric Rosa, who was the CEO of Oracle Data Cloud, that that was one of the best contracts, most easy-to-use contracts ever. And like, to my knowledge, it has like protected Oracle and protected customer understanding of like what's going on and partner understanding of what's going on. In fact, they still use the contract. It's a little longer now, but it's on their website.
2-page double column, single space, typeface, 8.
No, no, no. It was a good contract. And so
I believe you.
There is this like belief that like you're getting paid by the hour and you got to write the longest, most like kitchen sinkish contract ever. And like, if you miss one thing, everything's going to end. But there are catch-all methods to like account for that. There are ways to like streamline agreement. And like, lawyers self-aggrandizing is something that happens in contracts all the time. And I find that to be really, really like unnecessary and boring. I don't know, Alan, maybe you disagree.
No, I couldn't agree more. I think you said it well.
Stop writing all this shit down. Like, you know, like write the things down that are part of the promise. And write things down that are part of the, you know, like the deliverable, and then sign it.
I want to ask you, since you've been doing the ad stuff for so long, like, what do you think are like the seminal moments in sort of ad tech as you think about, you know, what changed things, though? What changed the game the most over time? There's probably a few that come to mind.
Yeah. So I think when Omar Tawakkol introduced the data being separate from the media, I think that was a big moment. And candidly, it was looked at a little suspiciously at the time because it was new. And I think one of the reasons that Omar had brought me in was he realized that it's going to be looked at oddly because it's new and you need to really make sure you double up on the making sure that you articulate the value prop in a way that comes off as privacy safe. So that would probably be the first one. The second one would be the acquisition of DoubleClick by Google.
I was waiting for that one.
Yeah. And then the third one, which I think doesn't get talked about enough, was when Google decided to kind of merge all of their entire data set into one big pool, thus commingling identifiable personal data with pseudonymous personal data. Because that really was the beginning of the end of privacy, wasn't it?
Are you talking about the end of privacy? Are you talking about when they did that more recently? Or are you going all the way back to like Abacus?
Oh, no. So the Abacus thing was, it's funny with Abacus because that was probably less about what they were actually doing and more about what people thought they were doing.
The idea that it happened, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'm saying this was, I remember a debate on this at on the NAI board. It must have been 2012, 2013. Sometime around then when they made that announcement, because I think that was really the game changer.
Got it.
I don't know. Do you guys have a different era?
I definitely agree on the double click. I love the shout out to Blue Kai and Omar. I think like Omar was, by the way, the business sponsor for me at Oracle for writing that 2-page contract. Just to be super clear, he was the lead of the Oracle Data Cloud at the time. And he was like, yeah, we're going to die with the Oracle MSA. We need to do something different. And to Oracle's credit, Oracle's like, yeah, let's fucking do it, which was pretty cool. But anyway, agree with you on the like, I think Blue Kai wasn't the first of the like ad tech lumascape, but it really was the like accelerant for a lot of
definitely.
Like, programmatic, you know, like ad tech, lumascape-y stuff. So agree on that. Definitely hear you loud and clear on DoubleClick. The Google move is important. I think like the mass adoption of Pixel, like anybody's Pixel, Facebook, Google, whoever, like mass adoption of Pixel by publishers, which is not a decision moment by one entity, but is a like a wave, is like the other big, I would probably add that to your list of seminal moments. Because like once Pixel, Google, Facebook, pick whoever, doesn't matter, add this, anybody's pixels, like started showing up everywhere. Like the, you know, like the granularity of personalization like went through the roof, and it really like emphasized the value of third-party data for the big platforms like Google and Facebook and, you know, whoever,
That's a good one. I have another one to add. I like your blue tie example, Alan, because
really like that.
I was I was on a legal team at a brand, TD Ameritrade, and we were onboarding ad tech for the very first time. The first deal we did was blue tie, right? Like that's the first DMP, and that was the first exposure for many people to that whole I could use my cookies this way. So that was definitely a seminal moment for lots of brands as they were coming into advertising. The other one, I think, and maybe I'm biased having worked at a DSP, but I think like real-time bidding in general, just when RTB started happening, like it's one thing to have a DMP and use your cookies in a certain way and buy ads, but it's a totally different thing to buy them programmatically and buy them at the speed that those ads and auctions are happening at that speed.
I think that's a great one. My issue with that as a choice is it's not clear to me that felt like that was a 5 to 7 year progression.
Yeah, movement.
And so it's harder to, at least as I get my head around it, it's harder to say, you know, this is the, you know, from this period on, because it took, you know, cause I'm thinking like, I remember, you know, Right Media back in what, 08? But I think what you're talking about with it was probably closer to 4 years later.
Mm-hmm. It was later. Yeah, I think you're right. It's a movement towards something, and you could sort of say the same thing about header bidding and other things that happened over time.
But to your point, the magnitude of that movement probably dwarfs, you know, two out of the three things that I brought up.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to be a homer here and throw one more in there because I think we're missing a big one. Facebook invented the feed, and now everybody uses the feed. And like feed is the surface on which like the most effective, in my opinion, personalized advertising that is most valuable to people exists, right? Because like disruptive ads, like you know, blocking ads are nuisance in a way that in feed ads are just not. So there's like less pain for people there. And then I think the other piece is like putting relevant ads in front of people while they're thinking about the information related to those ads, I think is just like a genius move to make people like receive their marketing in the context of which they are already operating based on what they're doing organically. And I think like took digital advertising from like a really cool supplementary piece of marketing to TV and radio to like the centerpiece of marketing for a lot of people. I think feed did that. So I know that's a
great point. Yeah. And it's funny. I remember when feed was just introduced, there was actually a lot of concern about, wait a minute. So everybody's going to be able to see. And it's funny. You almost have to bifurcate privacy issues because there's a certain percentage of them that it's just consumers need a little time to get used to things. And the feed is sort of a great example of that. Where there's other things that I think are larger sets of challenges, but the feed was the value outdrove the privacy concern.
Interesting stuff. What's next, Alan? And now we ask you what do you think is next?
I was thinking going that.
There? What's next? Yeah,
I
was thinking that.
I don't know. So the thing I'm spending a lot of time focusing on is the deprecation of the third party cookie, because I like to call things as I see them. And to me, this is Google's attempt to overturn the table because they realize that the Department of Justice and some other folks have them dead to rights on some issues and that the table is going to be overturned and they're just sort of blowing up the bridge on their way out the door.
I like that, blowing up the bridge. I thought about it that way.
There's an irony, by the way, and then I'll get off my little soapbox here, but there's an irony because, you know, privacy folks tend to say, oh yeah, this is great. You're mimicking Apple. It's this thing where, you know, you're going to control all this data. And that way these horrible ad tech companies aren't going to get it. And these horrible cookies aren't going to get used. But really the output of that is that there's going to be a larger sets of data in a smaller number of hands. And I'm not sure that that's really great for privacy. And not to mention that when you get rid of cookies, you get rid of the ability for advocates and regulators to actually audit what in the world is going on. And so all those concerns about algorithmic transparency and, you know, where is the data really going? Well, if you don't have cookies, I'm not sure how you're going to be able to figure that kinds of stuff out.
To me, it almost feels like people like sort of poking at a technology that worked pretty well. You know, like what's more privacy centric, truthfully, the cookie or whatever comes next? You know, there's a big question mark.
There's a demonization of cookies. Look, there was misuse of cookies. There was misuse of cookies. Anybody pretending like there wasn't is like fucking lying. So like people misuse the cookies and like that's how the cookie became the devil in the room or whatever. But like the technology itself, to Alan's astute point just now, like does have the potential to help on the back end with a lot of things, including like fairness assumption or fairness investigations and understanding how different groups of people are interacting with ads and with other technologies and with personalization more broadly that I don't know how we're going to solve for in these sandboxes, right? I really don't. And so, or in Apple's approach, which is sledgehammering, right? So like, I don't know. I get that we're optimizing to solve for some very specific problems. I think you're right to say that Google is solving for like external pressure, but also like just looking to move off of a technology that everybody hates, you know, like, well, not everybody, but like the politicals hate, the public hates everybody.
Yeah.
If I go to my friends and talk about cookies on their computer, they don't know what they are, but they feel they're bad. Like this is what cookies are now, right?
Right. But
yeah, go ahead.
So this is where it gets to the seminal moments from a moment ago when you merged the identifiable with the pseudonymous, because here's where we're transitioning. We're blowing up the pseudonymous world because we're not going to allow cookies and we're not going to allow, you know, probabilistic. And so it's at the very same time that larger entities are focusing on logged in relationships and even verifying those logged in relationships. So we're moving away very quickly from the ability to surf the internet anonymously on almost any site that adds value. Well, yeah. Think about that for a minute.
I think that's a huge factor. And like, it's probably, I think you're probably right that's the trajectory we're on. I mean, I do want to give like companies like Google some credit because they're making the changes that like external factors are demanding of them. This is what they're doing, right? They're being responsive to the signal they're getting from policymakers and from regulators and from users about like how they feel about cookie technology. That's the right thing to do if you're a company. And Google's been in an experimental phase now for years, trying to figure out what the next thing is and how to implement it, which is very different approach than some other companies who have said, here's what we're going to do, and you're just going to have to deal with it, right? And whatever that is, we know best. That is not the Google approach. So while, like, I hear you, and I think that there is definitely, like, some self-preservation elements to what Google is doing, I do see it, though, as a, like, not that the technology itself creates more transparency, but a more transparent attempt at revolutionizing the way digital advertising is delivered to get away from the things that have been scapegoated and made to be perceived as evil by everyone almost universally. Right or wrong doesn't matter.
Fair enough. It's a very clear distinction between how Apple has done things and how Google has done things. Although Apple has always been closed, Google has supported a very vibrant ecosystem. Correct. And the challenge is that it's not clear to me that any of these tools work even at a fraction of the level of efficiency that the previous tools work. That's point number one.
That is clear.
Point number two is that I don't know anybody who thinks that you can build a scalable business off the backs of this thing. And so like, if you were a DSP, like, yeah, you're going to experiment, you're going to like, you know, play around with it a little bit, but are you really confident that you're going to be able to build something off of this? And I can tell you from, you know, nobody's talking about this publicly because they're terrified because everybody's got some money going to, you know, to or from Google. But if you talk to anybody privately about this, there's no way they're going to build a business off of this.
What do you do if you're the Trade Desk? I mean, they're a pretty significant example. They're like, Trade Desk market cap is bigger than Ford Motors now. Like, that's a shocking statement in and of itself for three of us that have watched that company, you know, go from zero to that. But they certainly, this is a critical issue.
Implications
for them.
Are huge for them. Yeah.
Well, I don't work with them, but I would imagine, you know, you've got UID2, you've got some flavor or probabilistic, and also just know that the browser is really only one of the areas that they're in big. Right. And so, you know, there's a whole bunch of other places where they're seeing growth opportunities. And so, I think it's unfortunate that effectively the browser market is literally going to be squashed. And then for the next couple of years, it's going to be a game of whack-a-mole, as you know, because once you get rid of third-party cookies, then the next step is to try to figure out how to get rid of probabilistic or other alternative identifiers. And so this is going to be the game that they're in. I guess they're betting that the hit that they're clearly going to take in the browser world is going to be supplemented in other areas.
TV,
absolutely.
Yeah, I'm in TV now, so I'm keenly interested in whether that's the next growth surface area. It's such a different animal. There's no cookies, so it's a different delivery mechanism for sure.
Absolutely.
Nice pause.
Alan looked like he had something incredibly.
I thought all of us were going to say something, and then we all just ended up being quiet.
That should be the clip. That should be the clip we use. By the way.
Andy, you brought TV in, so like it's a topic that like. Because I'm at Meta, like have gotten away from over the years, but like used to be really involved in at Oracle and a little bit at Salesforce, but not so much. Like, you know, linear, over the top, whatever, you know, everybody knows all the distinctions, but like, what is, you mentioned that no cookies on the TV side, but man, there is like an amazing repository of first party captive attention data, right? Because like when you're watching TV, I'm not like scrolling through a feed. I'm sitting there watching 10 episodes of the same thing, right? And there is a lot of insight there about that can be really valuable in a marketing context. Like, I think like the value of how do TV, I don't know what the right word is, but how do like, what do you guys call yourselves? What do TV companies call yourselves? Not publishers. What do you guys call
programmer? Next publisher programmers. Or programmer. Yeah.
Publishers and programmers. How do you guys think about like the potential of like deriving signal out of those in-depth, long form attention capture data sets that you don't need cookies for, by the way? You could, you know, like especially not on on over the top, right? Like, I don't know, you tell me.
Is this for me or Alan for his
TV clients?
For
you, man. You're the TV guy. Shit. Tell me how the TV is going to work.
I definitely want to hear how you guys think about it. But, I mean, the VPPA is causing it's a lot of big challenge, right? Like, big challenge. Big challenge in terms of how you can, you know, actively get consent from somebody to tie their show watching behavior data to an identifier. And so I think smart TVs have one way of engaging. I just bought one. I just bought a Samsung smart TV and went through the you know, consent process. But we're the only people that sort of do that and look at it and think about it and read it. And meanwhile, I had a 7-year-old over my shoulder, like, come on, like, get the TV on. I want to see the consent mechanism. Now, so like, I looked at it shortly and it looked like, you know, they were getting some consent for some data rights and some data usage on the Samsung device. So device is one way, Pedro. I think the streaming services are another way. But we haven't gotten to the place yet where I think your people are really getting really, really robust VPPA consent for a host of reasons. I think one is like lawsuits. There's a ton of active lawsuits right now about VPPA. So people are sort of like, well, I'm not going to open myself up to that. And then I think how durable would that consent be if I got it? And so I think there's some risk there. So people instead are, you know, doing the same kind of activities they do in the ad tech world with identifiers and onboarding and sort of loose audience creation used for, not loose, I would say, data-driven, you know, linear TV and then data-driven measurement.
Yeah, I think it's all about the IP address in TV right now. Yeah. It's IP address bolstered by some additional data points, whatever you can kind of scrounge. And, you know, VPPA is always a concern. You know, it's funny. There's one more seminal moment. You can go back to the Reagan era because it all comes back to, you know, Judge Bork. His nomination is the whole reason. But Bork really reinvented competition law in the states, or at least how it was enforced. And say what you will about the approach that the FTC is taking, but they believe, rightly or wrongly, that it would be better if we shifted to a pre-mid-1980s or a pre-Bork view of competition law.
What exactly, can you elaborate on that? What exactly is sort of like the pre-Bork view?
Well, I think I'm way over my skis here, but I would say that pre-Bork, the evaluation of competition was a little bit different than post-Bork. I think that the pendulum has probably had swayed for a number of years in a way that favored corporations a little bit more and looked less suspiciously on larger corporations and on mergers. Now, you know, there's a whole debate about what the FTC's tactics in a whole bunch of areas. A friend of mine, and I won't spoil it by giving his name, but he said that the FTC would currently object to the merger of ketchup and French fries.
Oh my God, I want to steal that. Can I steal that?
Yeah, you sure can.
They would object to the merger of ketchup and French fries, and also anyone Meta wants to buy.
No comment. Yeah, but
no comment needed. That's my comment.
And I'm not trying to poke at pain points here. I'm just saying.
No, it's good, and it's the right thing.
There's a shift in philosophy that I think you can trace back to the mid '80s.
The lesson for me here is that the question I asked was a stupid one because I forgot about VPPA, right? But it does illustrate how disruptive and, like, I don't want to say, imbalanced a sector-based rule can be, right? That was created sort of like, you know, knee-jerky to protect some politicians from, like, their porn viewing habits, right? Like, this is what happened, right? And so I'm not saying it's not appropriate to protect people's viewing history and to create rules around it. But I think, like, this unique law is showing that, like, it's causing an entire sector to be treated as more sensitive than others when there's way more sensitive things out there than what I watch on HBO. Like,
yeah, and the litigation is problematic for a host of reasons. But I think also, like, it's problematic to me because there's a very clear bargain to be made with a TV viewer where trading value, value that could be given to a TV viewer. Like, you know, if you're a streaming service, for example, like, here's 5 free titles. Here's a break on your monthly bill. Here's a trade-off that's made explicitly for data rights about advertising. I think you could get it. But I think, like, the world, the environment, it's just making it too difficult to get it.
And Andy, you touched on this, but really the real lesson here is do not craft legislation that offers a private right of action. Because but for that private right of action, we would never be talking about VPPA right now.
It's a good point. Okay.
Hey, the privacy Taliban hates your guts right now. They're like, no!
Get ready in Washington State, folks.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, we'll see. It's a good point. Well, one more topic, maybe on self-reg, since you're the chair of the Network Advertising Initiative Board. You've been active with that organization for a long time. Both of us have in past roles. So I'm really interested in your opinion. Like, what's the future look like for the Network Advertising Initiative and really self-reg sort of writ large, now that we have just a different, like, environment and surface area of laws as when it was, you know, created?
Yeah. So I think they start from a great place. I mean, there's a lot of institutional knowledge at the NAI around how the ad tech space works, what challenges are being raised, particularly for the small, the startup folks. And heck, we need as much innovation in the ad tech space as we can get. We don't have enough. And some of that's the fault of ad tech. But to the extent that that's being supported by the NAI, by having just, you know, folks who can kind of walk companies through what the rule set is, that's a wonderful thing. But we've had to grapple now with the reality that the marketplace is so fundamentally different now than it was, you know, even 5 years ago, let alone 15 years ago. You know, Andy, I was saying this before, like my big sell to CEOs at ad tech companies with 15, 20 years ago was like, look, there's not a lot of rules out there. But if you go 10% above what everybody else is doing, you will lower the friction and you will get more deals done. And that was a very, very compelling message back then. And candidly, the NAI supported that because they had the, you know, the opt-out page and the set of rules. But we're now at a point where state law has far exceeded what the industry codes are. And it really has caused a rethinking around what the role of self-reg is going to be. Because if you arguably already have law that goes well above what many companies are able to do and still stay in business anyway, well, what's the role of the self-reg organization? And so we're going to have to pivot. And I think we're going to pivot around guidance. Okay, so, you know, the NAI published, what, 2-3 weeks ago, health guidance that incorporated, maybe not Washington State so much, but really the Colorado and California, and to a certain extent, HHS views of health data. That's wildly important in an area that still, despite you've got at least 4 regulatory agencies harping on it, it still lacks clarity. And so the NAI has been able to provide, hopefully, some additional clarity there. And I think you're going to see that, you know, with respect to opt-outs or the global privacy control. Like, you know, some states require the global privacy that, you know, purveyors of global privacy control take certain steps. You know, you can't have it on by default. You can't use it to self-preference, those types of things. Other states, including the great state of California, do not have those types of rule sets. So, you know, hopefully the NAI can become kind of maybe an honest broker around, you know, what is reasonable to expect with a global privacy control, and what does it mean to honor one from the perspective of a pseudonymous ad tech company? I could go on and on, but that's the type of things that I still think there's a huge amount of gray area in the industry, despite the fact that the rule set is sometimes is a lot higher. And so that's the thing that we're working to, and I'm super excited. I think the NAI now has the strongest team that they've ever had, from Lee to David to Anthony to Tony. We just hired Tony Ficarota from the IAB, and he was previously at the NAI, and he's one of the smartest guys in the ad tech legal space. So they've got, and the whole team is just super strong. I'm very excited.
There's a gap in TV, in the TV world as well, for this kind of like well-led and well-thought-out group guidance on very unclear issues around privacy and ad tech and the delivery of those services. So I'm glad to hear that there's rethinking going on, because there's a ton of value that could be there.
Well, good. And hopefully that, you know, I know that they are, there's a couple of TV companies, I believe, that are NAI members who have been historically, you know, I would say this. Now more than ever, there's a huge amount of value to be driven by having an independent voice of the third-party ad tech companies, particularly in light of everything else that's going on, some of it privacy-related, some of it not privacy-related. You really need that independent voice, and the NAI has been that, and I think will continue to be that for years to come.